It's been less than 5 months since President Trump instituted the so-called zero-tolerance immigration policy. The latest data from U.S. Customs and Border Protection shows that since October, more than 382,000 people have been detained at the southwestern border of the United States. That's nearly 54,000 more people than during the same period in 2017. Trump also, of course, implemented a policy of forced separation of parents from more than 2,000 minor children. Last week, it was reported that a migrant toddler died shortly after being released from a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement detention center in Texas. And later this week, the Texas state government will hold hearings on how it regulates these controversial centers. More than 460 parents have been deported without their children after being separated at the border since April. And last Thursday, the Trump administration informed a federal judge that it isn't responsible for locating deported parents separated forcibly from their children. Rather, the Department of Justice said in a court filing, it is the American Civil Liberties Union that should be taking the lead in reunifying deported parents with their children. To discuss the latest developments, we're now joined with Denise Bell, a researcher for refugee and migrant rights at Amnesty International USA, and Kathleen Caron, executive director of Justice in Motion. Its Defender Network includes more than 40 organizations in Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and Nicaragua. They've been working to reunify separated families, specifically parents who've been deported while their children remain detained in U.S. custody. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Denise Bell, let's start with you. Can you give us an update on the legal case holding the administration to reuniting those families separated at the border, as the president himself did say that he would do?
Yes. So right now what we have is that the majority of the families have been reunited, but not all of them. And that's because more than 400 parents have been deported and we simply cannot find them. However, some other children, there are about nearly 600 children who are still here. Some of them because their parents are have been deported, but other children are still in the custody of foster care of the U.S. government because of so-called red flags, which may be a criminal record. There might be what we don't know. We just simply don't know. But also they can't find the parents. They simply can't find the parents in the U.S.
And that's that's how many children then, with parents who have been red flagged or parents who are still within the United States but haven't been reunited with their children?
Yeah, so that would say, I would say that those number, I'm looking at this, are about 67 children with parents who have so-called red flags. And then there are 94 children whose parents' location is unknown. Now that's as of the end of July.
And that's of parents who haven't been deported. Of the children and parents that have been reunited while still in the United States, are they still in the United States or have the families then been deported?
Now, I would add that I would just like to add one other thing, that there are 120 parents who waived their rights to reunification with their children, and that the ACLU and other legal advocacy groups are examining this because they don't know whether the parents had gave full consent and understood what they were doing, or if there was some form of coercion. But for the families who were reunified, a number of them are detained together and are facing the threat of deportation because the parents, around 900 families or parents that would be have, are facing deportation.
So 900 of them are now facing deportation with their children. And then as you mentioned, and I said at the start, more than 460 parents were deported without their children. So, Kathleen, can you describe the Defender Network and how exactly it's been working to reunify separated families?
Yes, I'd love to do that, Antonia. Thank you. So, the Defender Network is comprised of human rights organizations and individual attorneys in the countries that you listed, in Mexico and Central America. And we've been working for over a decade on ensuring that migrants' rights cross borders on to address labor abuses that have occurred in the U.S., but workers go back to the country of origin, helping secure evidence in the country of origin to ensure that people fleeing violence or persecution can remain safely in the U.S. because we get evidence to support their claims. We launched a civil rights project just this past year to focus on the increased abuses during arrest detention and then removal of migrants. So we've really been working on this issue and kind of ready to respond. So we have jumped in on the family reunification issues and looking for those 400 deported parents in the countries of origin.
And talk about those efforts then, what it means to look for those parents and how successful you've been and how you go about it.
Sure. We're pulling from various sources of information, and we have the government lists, which aren't complete, and that's the ACLU's leading the charge and sorting through that. So if we have information that is, you know, good enough, we try to go out and find that particular deported parent. So our Defender Network and some other allies who are going to be coming down to Central America to also work on the effort with us, our goal is to interview each deported parent. So we need to figure out what the circumstances are of the removal of the child, whether there were due process violations. We need to find out what that parent would like to do with reunification. So the other colleague on the phone talked about, you know, what were those circumstances of removal? Was there due process violations? Were they deceived? Was there fraud involved? Was there pressure? Did they really give up their child? There's also those red flags that were mentioned. That's also really important. We worked on at least one case so far where the parent weren't allowed to be reunified, at least initially, because of a criminal record in the country of origin. That's another thing our Defender Network is really good at doing, is debunking these criminal accusations, because in that case it was false. So there's a lot of parents who are probably still in the United States that we could also assist in the sense of, if their attorneys contact us, we could look into what those accusations are in the countries of origin to be able to disprove them, or maybe they're legitimate. But the point is, they deserve that chance to have that access to due process. So we're just trying to get the individualized interviews to determine what they want for family reunification. So there's kind of three basic options: that the child could be sent back to the country of origin. The parent could be paroled using humanitarian immigration parole into the United States to be reunified there and then deported, or perhaps for them to pursue their own claim for some sort of immigration relief. We've been hearing lots of reports that people express fear at the border but were not allowed to present an asylum claim. So there might be a lot of parents that fled in fear to protect their children and themselves, and we have some cases of those already, so there might be an option there. Or, of course, to let the child, for the parent to remain in the country of origin and for the child to pursue their own immigration options in the United States, which would be kind of what already happens for unaccompanied minors. But each parent deserves that interview to be fully informed and to make the decision that's best for their family.
What I understand is that so thousands of people are being put on 747s and flown from the U.S. border back to their country of origin. What meets them when they get there? And what if they are someone who, you know, against their wishes, got on a plane and left their child or their grandchild, you know, God knows where, in the United States, and now they're sitting on a tarmac in Guatemala, presumably a country they've left out of fear for being there. You know, what greets them when they get off the plane, and how does one figure out if they're how to reconnect them with their child?
Well, they're immediately greeted by the government, and so as they move out, they're processed by the government. There's some services they're provided right there, a little bit of money to return, bus ticket. They have to do interviews, and then they leave the airport. They're in a separate part of the airport in the Guatemala City airport. Obviously, Honduras and El Salvador are distinct, but how Guatemala, where most of these people are being returned to, works. They are received that way, and then there's kind of this long corridor where certain nonprofits and some of our defenders working with local allies line up to try to ask people, you know, these questions: have you been deported without your child? And so that's one way to do it. I mean, that's really difficult to do because the migrants have already been locked up for hours. They just want to get home. They're exhausted. Many are fearful. Many are humiliated. I mean, there's a lot of things. Like, a lot of these people are being returned in shackles, right? And they're not removed. The shackles aren't removed until they're on Guatemala territory. So really another way to go is proactively. Like, we have an email that we're circulating. We have a phone number in Guatemala that's dedicated for that parents can call. So it can also be family members. So, you know, for the parents that are lost in the United States, if it's a family member in the country of origin that knows, you know, their sister is looking for their child in the United States, you know, we also can kind of connect them to the right services. So we're not doing direct services. We're not representing the children. We're not representing the parents. Our key role is to find the deported parents, give them that interview, and then coordinate with the massive U.S. undertaking, which is going on, for that has all the children represented, and there's NGOs that are stepping up to represent all the parents who are deported to figure out their claims. And that's quite a coordination effort. So we are going down to Guatemala next week to kind of ramp up our efforts in the countries of origin, because now that we have more insight into the numbers, like, we need to do much more than we were originally doing a month ago.
So assuming you don't catch up to someone in the airport corridor as they're deboarding their plane from the U.S. border, can you kind of describe what the process is of locating someone in their country of origin?
Yes. So if we have sufficient detail, we literally go out. And so that could be, you know, that could be driving 8 hours or going in a bus, dealing with a landslide. I mean, it's rainy season in Guatemala. The rain starts in June, it ends in November. The infrastructure is very poor. I mean, there's a reason why people, migrants, are fleeing Guatemala and countries and Central American countries, because the state is not protecting people that suffer, you know, abuse and violence. So the infrastructure as well is kind of collapsing. You know, there's many problems happening. So just traveling around Guatemala is really difficult and very dangerous, right? You have a lot of drug trafficking going on. There's areas that you have to know really well how to navigate in and navigate subtly, because you could be in serious danger yourself, our defenders. I mean, that's just the beauty of the Defender Network, is that we're working with human rights lawyers on the ground that know how to do this. I mean, they've been searching for people and motivating people to stand up for their rights for their whole careers, right? So we're just kind of leveraging the resources that already exist and bringing, you know, the country of origin advocates into this transnational dialogue, because it really requires a transnational solution. The other way we're doing this is more generalized. So we've been putting on radio spots and community radio stations all over the country. Those started getting launched over the weekend. We already have the churches, as much as we can, talking up to the higher ups in the Catholic Church, that every pulpit around the country is going to have a flyer to be reading from to refer people to the phone number that we have set up in Guatemala that the defenders are running, and an email as well.
Denise, what does it mean that the Trump administration has said that it's not their responsibility to locate parents that it forcibly separated from their children who are still here in the United States?
Well, what I think it means is that it's another indication of the total abdication of responsibility of this administration for the policy and for the chaos that they created. I mean, they forcibly separated more than 2,500 families, and then only 1,900 have been reunited. And of those, 900 parents are still facing deportation and have to make a decision whether they'll leave their children here or not. And then to say that the ACLU and partners such as Justice in Motion are responsible, I mean, that's ludicrous. And as the government said, as the judge said, it's 100% the responsibility of the government to sort out the mess that it made.
And the Trump administration has also been, or President Trump, excuse me, has been going around the world talking about some of the most extremist, migration and anti-immigrant policies that he finds, estimable. How do things look moving forward in terms of policy? Does it look like there are policy solutions to this problem that are actually being presented, or that the zero tolerance policy is only likely to get worse?
Well, I do think that what we're looking at is a continuing assault on the system of asylum, which is codified in U.S. law as well as international human rights law. And while the government has said that it has not rescinded its so-called zero tolerance policy, we can anticipate that once it seeks funding and receives it to expand detention, that it will return to that. And that's why we're being very vigilant to prevent the expansion of family detention, which the government has offered as a cruel solution to its policy of forcible family separation. So we are watching this closely. There are our legislators in both chambers of Congress that have proposed bills that would write into law a presumption against family detention. would also write into law a presumption against, would write into law actually a protection for people who cross the border in between ports of entry from criminal prosecution if they're seeking asylum, and also would write into law an end to forcible family separation as deterrence policy.
I also read that Amnesty International is advocating for the reinstatement of the Family Case Management Program. Can you say what that is and when it was terminated and what it would do?
Yes, absolutely. So instead of detention doesn't need to happen, and it's actually unlawful under our international human rights obligations to detain anyone simply for immigration purposes. And we advocate for the least invasive and onerous alternatives to detention instead. And one would be the Family Case Management Program, which was proven to be 99% effective in guaranteeing that families went through all of the immigration process. However, the Trump administration terminated this contract in early 2017. And so they actually wiped out the solution that is both humane, rights respecting, and cost efficient.
Go ahead, Kathleen. It sounds like you wanted to jump in.
Oh, sure. Just thinking about kind of longer term policy strategies. If the administration was saying that this is to prevent migration, it really has nothing to do with that. There's plenty of policy fixes that could address the root causes of migration. So our government doesn't have the best track record in Central America of taking measures to deal with policies that are forcing people to migrate. So we only want people to migrate out of choice, not out of force. And there's no question that people are being forced to make these drastic decisions and putting their children at risk. Crossing Mexico is a huge risk for children, right? But parents are making these decisions knowingly because they're choosing between two evils, right? So what are they going to do? So for them to show up at the border and then to be seeking protection and refuge, leaving a country that's not protecting them, that has, you know, high impunity rates, high corruption, high murder rates, and, you know, high domestic violence. I mean, that's one of the kind of least discussed points of why women flee, because the states are failing to protect them when they see protection, and Jeff Sessions is rolling that back. So can you just imagine a woman who has made this decision to risk her life and her child's life and sexual assault that happens on the route to the United States to show up, fleeing for their lives, risking sexual abuse, showing up at the border, and then having your child removed? I mean, it's hard to imagine a more preposterous situation. So Trump is not talking about a policy solution. He's not talking about how to prevent migration, because this has nothing to do with it. When you have refugees, they're going to seek safety no matter what, because what are their choices? To stay and die, or to risk moving on and protecting your family? So let's talk about the facts and what they could do. That's much more low cost, you know, not in the front lines of the media for 3 months, that they really could make a difference for migrants not to come to the United States.
Can you also talk about you've both been working with these families now for many months. What are some of the more individual story that has struck you that we should hear?
Sure. Well, I think some of the ones we've seen, we've talked to 12, just 12, because we're really just starting up, 12 deported parents so far, and kind of been involved with three reunifications. Like, our role really is the individualized interviews with the deported parents. But it's pretty heartbreaking to hear the stories that, you know, that people risk their lives to get up there and then sent back. And the fear, and a lot of them want to keep their children in the U.S., made that coercive decision because they thought it's going to be worse for my child to get sent back. And if that's my only option, I'd rather my child be safe. And the tragedy is it wasn't the only option, but that was kind of how it was presented. So the stories are really heartbreaking of these young children, right? And sometimes the parents are talking to the child who's detained, but, you know, the child is four. She's not going to say, get on the phone with my lawyer so you can figure this out, right? So there's so many missing pieces to connect the dots to get the legal support that these parents deserve.
Denise?
I would disagree that what I'm thinking of is the families that I have met who came to the U.S. and just didn't understand that this was happening in the United States, because this wasn't the country that they'd heard about. And they did everything that they were supposed to. They followed U.S. law. They said, I'm here to seek asylum. and then they were told that they didn't have a right to their child. And I don't understand how this could be happening here, as many of us don't. And those are the heart-rending stories that we have to remember as we continue to fight these policies that seek to punish and deter people for seeking safety. I mean, for doing what any of us would do when we were in that situation.
Denise, I wanted to clarify something you said at the outset of the interview. It's allegedly 120 parents who waived their right to reunification. Are they all parents who have been deported, who meet that category?
I am not sure. My understanding is that they have been deported.
So it was people who accepted deportation to get out of detention in the course of filling out the paperwork. The government is saying they waived their right to be united with their children.
Yes, that they waived it, thinking, they probably thought, my understanding is that they believed that this would be a in the best interest of their child, or that they would be reunified faster with their child.
And Kathleen, do you know of the 12 people that you've tracked down out of country? Has any of them been one of the people who purportedly waived the right to reunification?
I would imagine that all of them did, because they were deported. So we're trying to figure that out, right? And those numbers are much higher. I mean, we're talking over 300 deported parents in Guatemala alone, around 100 in Honduras, and then, you know, less than 10 in El Salvador. And that's what we know about. So that's the universe. So I mean, we need to talk to each parent, but they were certainly, they seemed like they signed paperwork and were sent back, right? So we just have to do that evaluation to say, okay, out of these 400 people, how many truly understood what they were doing? And maybe some of them absolutely did, right? But it doesn't seem like each one has to be analyzed.
Yeah, I have to say, it seems highly unlikely that people thought that this is a good idea. I mean, sorry, I'm sitting here a little flabbergasted, imagining the idea of the choices that were being presented to these parents. As you say, you're in detention. You must imagine that the way you're most likely to get to see your child again is if you sign the paper that's being put in front of you. And if that includes being deported, then you're deported. But of course, that's the hard work that you all are doing. So thank you so much for doing that, tracking down the parents and trying to find out exactly what needs to be done to get them reunified with their children. Our guests today have been Denise Bell, a researcher for refugee and migrant rights at Amnesty International USA, and Kathleen Caron, executive director of Justice in Motion. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.